So I want you to imagine a city, maybe a city a lot like yours, actually. And they just spent, I don't know, $50 million on this massive state-of-the-art smart city initiative.
Oh, yeah. We see this all the time.
Right, like we are talking about the works here. A command center that literally looks like a NASA control room. You've got real-time predictive analytics for traffic, sophisticated sensors monitoring water pressure and every single pipe, color-coded dashboards, tracking waste management, the whole nine
Right,
yards.
and the mayor probably holds a big press conference.
Exactly. The mayor points to the giant screens and declares, the era of inefficiency is over. The data is going to show us the way.
It is, well, it's the ultimate modern promise, isn't it? This belief that if we could just achieve total visibility, if we could just measure absolutely everything perfectly, then human behavior will just naturally correct itself.
Yeah, that the system will just fix its own dysfunction. But here's what actually happens a year later in this hypothetical city, which, by the way, is an incredibly common scenario.
Very common.
The sensors are still blinking red, right? They're showing that like 30% of the municipal water supply is still just leaking right into the ground. Traffic is somehow even worse than before. And public trust in the local government has basically hit rock bottom. And the crazy thing is, the data was flawless.
Yes, the information transfer was perfectly logical, instantaneous, and it completely failed to create any actual transformation.
Right. The physical lived reality of the people in that city just continued to degrade despite this massive $50 million dashboard. So the question we are really diving into today is why? Why does brilliant, perfectly data-driven policy just consistently fail when it makes contact with reality?
I mean, that is essentially the defining paradox of our entire era of governance and corporate management, too, really. We are just drowning in high fidelity data, but we are completely starved for actual coordination.
Yeah, starved for coordination. That's a great way to put it.
Because the assumption underpinning that whole control room is that human systems, governments, communities, departments, that they operate like machines.
Like we're just computers waiting for an update.
Exactly. We assume if you just input the right code, or present the undeniable facts, the machine will just execute the command. But, human beings aren't algorithms.
Which brings us to the actual mission of today's deep dive. We are looking at this truly fascinating academic white paper by Dr. Bechara Sokeli. It's called Life Coherent Transition, a Maturana-Informed Stakeholder Engagement Framework.
It's a bit of a mouthful, but the concepts are incredible.
It really is disruptive. We're going to unpack how to bridge this massive gap between technically precise policy frameworks and the actual messy, deeply subjective realities of the people who actually have to implement them.
And to do that, this paper introduces a really profound paradigm shift. It argues that we basically have to abandon the industrial mechanical model of management completely.
So stop treating people as machines.
Right. We need to stop treating human beings and institutions as passive targets for, like, buy-in. And instead, we have to start treating them as living biological systems.
Okay, so by the end of this conversation, you're going to understand why pristine data almost never changes a stubborn mind, why stakeholder resistance isn't just people being irrational, and how we can actually build what Dr. Saley calls a life-coherent world.
Yeah, but before we get into the how, we really need to tear down some of the jargon we hear every single day.
Oh, please do, because any corporate strategy or government mandate today is just littered with these vague aspirations, sustainability, resilience, inclusivity.
Right, and they sound amazing on a slide deck, but in practice, they usually just become meaningless branding exercises. You just slap a sustainable sticker on a highly destructive project, and nothing changes on the ground.
Yeah, the paper argues pretty strongly against this, right? Like this kind of linguistic drift. It demands precise distinctions.
Because a vague aspiration without a precise distinction just gets absorbed by the system you're trying to change. I mean, if you can't define exactly what you were sustaining, sustainability just means sustaining the current profitable dysfunction.
Sustaining the dysfunction. That makes sense.
So Dr. Sully lays out this foundational, almost biological vocabulary to ground the transition. And it starts with two absolutely critical concepts, the life ground and life capital.
Okay, let's put some meat on the bones of those terms because they are basically the foundation for everything else we're going to talk about today. What exactly is the life ground?
Well, the life ground is the foundational set of biophysical and social conditions that just make human life possible and viable and meaningful.
So, like the basics.
Yeah, at the most basic level, it's biophysical necessities, potable water, breathable air, fertile soil, accessible food, intact biodiversity.
Okay, that sounds like standard environmentalism so far.
Right, but the framework doesn't stop at the environment. That's the key. It explicitly includes social and relational conditions as part of the life ground, too.
Like what?
Like public health, education, care networks, physical safety, and, crucially, public trust.
Wait, I want to pause there, because including public trust alongside potable water as a foundational condition is a pretty big conceptual leap. Usually we treat the environment as one silo and social issues as a completely different silo. Why combine them?
Because biologically and socially, they function the exact same way. Okay. They're the prerequisites for any secondary activity. I mean, there's no functioning economy without a predictable water supply, right?
Right.
Well, there is also no functioning economy without a baseline of social trust. If public trust collapses, you can't enforce contracts, you can't coordinate labor. The system breaks down just as surely as if the water table dried up.
Oh, wow. Okay, so the life ground is the primary condition of all sectors. The water, the soil, the trust, the health. So what then is life capital?
So life capital is the accumulated stored capacity of those life ground conditions to sustain and regenerate life over time. It's the real tangible wealth of the society.
Give me an example of what that actually looks like in the real world. How do I know if I'm looking at life capital?
Okay, well, a fully restored watershed that naturally filters rainwater for a city, that is immense life capital. Or a population of youth who are highly educated, physically healthy, and actually feel a sense of belonging to their community.
So it's not just money in the bank?
Not at all. Resilient coastal mangroves that buffer a town against storms, or deeply trusted, transparent public institutions that can mobilize people during a crisis, these are all forms of life capital. It's a stored capacity to endure.
I see where this is going, and it really feels like a direct assault on conventional economics. Because in traditional accounting, a restored watershed doesn't necessarily show up as a massive asset unless, I don't know, you're bottling and selling the water.
That is exactly the critique here. Conventional economics constantly confuses monetized transactional activity with actual wealth creation. Under the current paradigm, you can have a society that is actively increasing its GDP while systematically destroying its life capital.
Wait, walk me through how that happens. How does a society get richer on paper while its actual capacity to sustain life is falling?
Okay, think about a developing coastal region. You could go in and bulldoze the protective coastal mangroves, pave over all the local agricultural land, and build this massive strip of luxury, all-inclusive resorts.
Okay, and the foreign investment pours in.
Exactly. Construction jobs cause a temporary spike in employment. Visitor arrivals skyrocket. On every single traditional dashboard, the GDP is rising, and the finance minister is thrilled.
But the life capital is plummeting.
Yes. You destroy the natural storm buffer, so now the inland communities are vulnerable to the next hurricane. You've paved over the food sovereignty of the region, so now they're entirely dependent on imported expensive food. The financial capital went up, but the actual capacity of that place to sustain its own people is in freefall.
Wow. And that dynamic right there is exactly what the paper refers to as misnesting, isn't it? This idea that we have the relationship completely backward.
Yes. Misnesting is a crucial concept here. In a healthy, life-coherent system, abstract, human-created systems like financial markets or tourism models, they are nested within the life ground.
They exist to serve it.
Right. They serve the primary life support systems. Misnesting happens when those secondary abstract systems kind of mutate, grow dominant, and start actively degrading the primary systems they were supposed to serve.
You know, when I was reading this section, I immediately thought of it like a video game.
Oh, really? How so?
Yeah, so imagine you're playing this complex strategy game, and you become totally obsessed with maximizing your score in the top right corner of the screen. You want the highest GDP, the highest profit margins, whatever. But to get that score higher, you are literally reaching behind the television and ripping the copper wiring out of the wall to feed into the console.
That's a great analogy.
Right. You're cannibalizing the physical infrastructure of the house just to keep the digital score ticking upward. And the score looks fantastic right up until the moment the power shorts out, the screen goes black, and the house catches fire.
That captures the delusion perfectly. What should be the servant, the score, or the financial abstraction becomes the master. And the really terrifying thing about missed nesting is how long it can hide behind that high score.
Yeah, a rising indicator can conceal falling life capacity for decades, can't it?
Absolutely. The system appears highly functional and profitable right up until a physical or social threshold is crossed.
Like an aquifer slowly salinizing. You don't even notice it until the water coming out of your tap is suddenly undrinkable.
Or public trust eroding over decades of inequality. Until, you know, one minor policy change suddenly triggers a massive riot. At that threshold, the life ground reasserts itself, and it returns as an unmanageable crisis.
Mm.
The abstraction collapses because physical reality just can't support it anymore.
Okay, so the goal of this entire framework, obviously, is to transition from the state of misnesting to a state of renesting. But I want to be really careful here. Is the paper basically arguing that we need to abandon finance, tear down the hotels, and revert to some pre-industrial agrarian utopia? Because that kind of rejection usually alienates the exact people we need to reach.
No, not at all. And that is a vital distinction. Renesting is not a rejection of modern complexity. It doesn't demand we abolish finance or smash the servers running our tech. It demands that we put them back in their proper place, serving life capital.
So it's an evolutionary step.
Yes, not a regression. It asks that economic activity be redesigned so that generating revenue actually increases the capacity for life rather than destroying it.
Okay, that sounds intellectually satisfying, but how do you actually operationalize that? How do you force a government bureaucracy or a corporate board to renest their priorities? The paper points to this mechanism called life capital budgeting. How does that differ from just a normal city budget?
Well, conventional budgeting categorizes expenditures by ministry or standard classifications like capital versus operational expenditure. It just asks, can we afford this line item this year?
Right.
Life capital budgeting asks a much more rigorous question. Does this allocation of resources actively build life capital, or does it generate a hidden liability?
Ah, hidden liabilities. Let's dig into that. Because this feels like the trick modern accounting uses to pretend we are richer than we are. What is a hidden liability in this context?
A hidden liability is a real physical or social cost that is generated in the present, but creatively displaced into the future or displaced onto a completely different department.
I need an example of that displacement. How does that work?
Let's look at municipal infrastructure. Say a city decides to cut the maintenance budget for its underground water mains to balance the fiscal budget for the year.
Okay, so on paper, the budget is balanced. The mayor looks fiscally responsible.
Exactly.
Okay.
But physically, the wear and tear on the pipes just continues. That deferred maintenance is a hidden liability. When the pipe eventually bursts 3 years later, it costs 10 times as much to repair it on an emergency basis.
Not to mention all the businesses that lose water pressure or the damaged road above the pipe.
Right. So what looks like fiscal prudence in the short term is actually massive fiscal recklessness over the long term.
That makes total sense.
Or look at public health. If a government allows the flooding of its market with ultra-processed, imported junk food because it generates high tariff revenues and keeps consumer prices low, they're creating a massive hidden liability.
Because 10 years later, that diet manifests as a diabetes epidemic.
Precisely. And suddenly, the Ministry of Health is bankrupt trying to pay for insulin and dialysis. The financial benefit was captured by the Trade Department in year one, but the hidden liability exploded in the Health Department in year 10.
Man, that's brutal. But life capital budgeting asserts that a budget ignoring those liabilities is effectively fraudulent, right? It says the most fiscally responsible expenditure is the preventative investment.
Exactly.
All right, so let's summarize where we are. We have established these really sharp distinctions. Life ground versus life capital. We can identify misnesting. We know the solution is life capital budgeting. So here is the million-dollar question. If we have all these clear definitions, why can't we just put them on a beautiful dashboard, present them to the CEO or the prime minister, and expect them to immediately change course?
And that brings us to the very heart of the implementation failure. Modern policy culture basically operates on a deeply flawed assumption. We assume that better evidence automatically leads to better decisions.
Because we think if the science is settled, society will just naturally adjust.
Right. But empirical evidence proves this is false every single day. I mean, a community can look at a dashboard showing they are losing 40% of their water to leaks and still entirely lack the trust or coordination to authorize the repairs.
Or a patient can be shown their blood work, know what a healthy diet is, and still buy junk food because of stress or habit. The evidence doesn't determine the transformation.
Exactly. And to explain why this happens, the paper relies heavily on the work of Humberto Maturana. It leans into what it calls a Maturana-informed framework.
Okay, so who is Humberto Maturana, and what biological insight is he bringing to this policy problem?
Maturana was a highly influential Chilean biologist and philosopher. His work on the biology of cognition, how living things actually know and interact with their world, is the engine driving this entire framework. And his central, highly disruptive insight is that living systems are structurally determined.
Okay, structurally determined. I need you to translate that out of academia for us. What does it actually mean for a human being or a city council to be structurally determined?
It means that a living system, whether that's a single cell, a human nervous system, or a complex organization, does not change simply because the outside world instructs it to change.
Wait, really?
Yeah. When a living system encounters information from the outside environment, that information does not dictate the system's response. The response is determined entirely by the internal structure of the system at that exact moment of interaction.
I am struggling to map that onto reality. Let's test this. Let's go back to our city with the $50 million dashboard. If I'm a consultant and I show the finance minister a dashboard that proves, objectively, that a massive water main is leaking 1 million gallons a day, are you telling me the data itself doesn't tell them what to do? Isn't a leak just an objective fact?
The physical reality of the water leaving the pipe is a fact, yes. But what that leak means and what action it triggers is entirely dependent on the internal structure of the person looking at it. Maturana argues that information from the outside can only perturb or trigger a system. It cannot specify the outcome.
Okay, so the dashboard is just a perturbation. It's just a trigger.
Yes. Think about how differently that exact same data point, that blinking red light, perturbs different human systems. An infrastructure engineer looks at it and sees a technical puzzle. Their internal structure triggers a desire to dig up the road and replace the valve.
Right.
But the finance minister looks at the exact same light, and their internal structure processes it as a massive, unbudgeted capital expense that threatens their credit rating.
Oh, I see. And a local politician up for re-election looks at the dashboard and sees a PR crisis because digging up that road will cause traffic jams for voters.
Exactly. And a hotel operator sees a threat to their water pressure right before tourist season. The stimulus is identical. The dashboard didn't change. But the reality it created in the minds of those four people was completely divergent.
That is absolutely fascinating. So you really can't assume that the clarity of your message equals the uptake of your message.
Not at all. A brilliant white paper, a pristine chart, these aren't instructions that download into someone's brain. They are merely perturbations. And depending on their internal structure, your perturbation might trigger innovation, or it might trigger intense fear and defensiveness.
Wow. If that's true, it completely invalidates how almost every organization operates today. If you can't just instruct a system to change with a PowerPoint, how does change actually happen? How do we ever manage to coordinate if we're all locked inside our own structurally determined realities?
We coordinate through a process Maturana called structural coupling.
Structural coupling. Okay, walk me through how that works.
Living systems don't change in isolation. They change through interaction. Structural coupling happens when two or more structurally determined systems engage in recurrent, repeated interactions over time.
Okay.
As they constantly perturb each other and respond, their internal structures gradually begin to adapt to one another. They develop a history of interaction. Over time, their behaviors become mutually responsive, and a new shared pattern of coordination emerges.
You know, it makes me think of two people trying to learn a complex ballroom dance. You don't just hand them a manual with the steps, point them at each other, and expect a perfect waltz.
No, definitely not.
You can't just instruct the dance. They have to get on the floor, they step on each other's toes, they push, they pull, they perturb each other's balance. But through repeated interaction, their nervous systems and muscles adapt to one another. And eventually, they're structurally coupled, and they move as a single coordinated unit.
That is a brilliant way to visualize it. And it really highlights why the standard model of policy implementation fails.
Yeah.
You cannot achieve structural coupling with a single stakeholder workshop on a Tuesday afternoon.
Or by releasing a 200-page PDF and demanding compliance.
Exactly. Which means the entire concept of trying to secure buy-in from stakeholders is fundamentally flawed.
Because it's the wrong paradigm. It implies that a small group of experts lock themselves in a room, design the perfect future, and now their only job is to use marketing or pressure to force everyone else to swallow it.
Right. You are treating the stakeholders like obstacles to be overcome or targets to be convinced. And this paper demands a massive shift in how we view those people. Under the Maturana framework, stakeholders are not audiences or targets. The paper refers to them as legitimate worlds.
Legitimate worlds. That carries a lot of weight. Encountering another person or a department not as an impediment to your plan, but as a fully legitimate world. But what makes their world legitimate if they're actively opposing a genuinely good idea?
Their world is legitimate because it is the valid result of their own structural history. Every stakeholder inhabits a distinct reality governed by its own constraints, its own historical traumas, its own incentives, and crucially, its own conserved concerns.
Let's unpack conserved concerns because I honestly think this is a superpower concept for anyone trying to navigate workplace politics or community organizing. Every single stakeholder is trying to conserve something, right?
Always. Every action a living system takes is ultimately an effort to conserve its own adaptation and identity in its environment. If you want to understand a stakeholder, you have to identify what they are trying to conserve.
Okay, let's run a scenario. Let's say we are trying to pass a sweeping new regulation in a coastal town that limits water usage for large businesses to protect the local aquifer. The major luxury hotels immediately launch a massive lobbying campaign to kill it.
Classic scenario.
Right. And the environmentalists call them greedy, evil corporations trying to destroy the planet. But if we look at them as a legitimate world, what are they trying to conserve?
Well, they aren't waking up in the morning twirling their mustaches and trying to destroy the aquifer. They are trying to conserve their world. They are trying to conserve their operational predictability. The aesthetic experience they promised to guests who expect lush green lawns. They're trying to conserve investor confidence and their ability to meet payroll for 500 local employees.
And if your brilliant, life-coherent water regulation threatens those conserved concerns, they will fight you to the death. Not because they hate the environment, but because you are threatening their survival within their specific context.
Exactly. This completely reframes how we view resistance. In traditional management, resistance is viewed as ignorance or bad faith. We ask, why don't they understand the data? But under this framework, resistance is structural. It is a biological defense mechanism.
So the very first question a leader must ask when faced with fierce resistance isn't, how do I defeat them?
No, the question is, what is this person trying to conserve that my proposal threatens?
And when you view resistance through that lens, you realize why top-down consultation breeds so much toxic cynicism. Because traditional consultation is usually just symbolic theater. The strategy is already written. The decisions are made.
Yes, and then they hold a town hall meeting just to check a compliance box.
Right. The stakeholders show up, voice their conserved concerns, the leaders nod solemnly and say, we hear you, and then they just implement the original plan anyway.
It's totally extractive. You're extracting their time and their input merely to legitimate a decision they had no actual power to shape. When stakeholders realize their conserved concerns aren't genuinely being integrated, their internal structure just closes off. Trust completely evaporates.
So Dr. Savely argues that we must move from this extractive model of buy-in to a model of true co-ownership. What does real co-ownership look like?
Co-ownership means that stakeholders recognize the transition process as partly theirs. Now, this doesn't mean everyone gets exactly what they want or that you compromise the life ground just to make people happy.
Right. It's not just a free-for-all compromise.
No. It means stakeholders are actively involved in naming the concerns, testing the definitions of the problem, designing the pilot programs, and holding the outcomes accountable. The transition is not a policy happening to them. It is a new reality they are bringing forth with you.
Okay, I am entirely on board with the theory here. Treating people as legitimate worlds, understanding their conserved concerns, aiming for co-ownership. It sounds beautiful, but how in the world do we actually coordinate this in reality?
It's a huge challenge.
If everyone is in their own structurally determined world, how do we stop having endless circular meetings and actually achieve transformation? The paper outlines a very specific methodology for this called the relational praxis spiral.
Yes, it is a structured methodology for bridging this complex biological theory into the messy reality of the field. And it's crucial to note that it's called a spiral, not a linear checklist.
Right, because human change doesn't happen in a straight line. You don't just finish step three, check the box, and never revisit it. You are constantly looping back through these steps, deepening the structural coupling with every iteration.
Exactly.
Let's walk through the eight steps of the spiral, and let's keep using our coastal town water crisis as the hypothetical playground to see how this actually works. So, step one, listen for conserved concerns.
In step one, you do not enter the room pitching your solution. You do not present the dashboard. You enter the room to map the stakeholders' worlds. You ask directly, what is becoming harder for you to sustain? What do you fear losing in this current situation?
So you listen to the hotel operator talk about investor fears, and you listen to the farmer talk about wells running dry.
Exactly.
Step two is translate distinctions into stakeholder worlds. This seems incredibly important. This is where you take your fancy academic frameworks like life capital budgeting, and you make them legible and relevant to the specific person in front of you.
Precisely. If you are sitting down with a group of working class parents, you don't use terms like biophysical life ground.
They'd look at you like you're crazy.
Right. You translate it. You say, we need to ensure that public money is used to guarantee the water comes out of your tap every morning and that your kids have a safe route to school. If you're talking to the Ministry of Finance, you translate the exact same concept into their language. You say, we need to identify the hidden liabilities in our infrastructure that are going to cause a massive, unbudgeted shock to our credit rating in 3 years. You have to meet them in their language.
Step three, identify shared pressures and hidden liabilities. I loved reading this part of the paper because this is where the facilitator starts to weave the separate worlds together. You show everyone in the room how their distinct, isolated problems are actually symptoms of the exact same systemic misnesting.
This is usually a moment of profound realization in a group. You draw the map together. You show how the hotel importing massive amounts of foreign, ultra-processed food for its buffet means the local farmers can't sell their produce. Because the farmers can't make a living, they sell their land to developers, which increases runoff into the ocean, which kills the reef. Meanwhile, the local population eating the cheap imported food develops a health crisis, which bankrupts the public health system.
And suddenly, the Minister of Health, the local farmer, and the hotel operator, who thought they had absolutely nothing in common, They look at the map and realize they're all caught in the exact same death spiral. The hidden liabilities are shared.
Exactly. Which leads directly to step four, co-design practical interventions. Now that they see the shared problem, they design the intervention together.
And this is where you need technical experts and lived experts at the same table, right? Because the engineer knows the exact hydraulic pressure limits of the new water pipe, but the community elder knows that the street where they want to put the pumping station floods every time it rains heavily, which would destroy the pump.
Yes, you need both to design a viable intervention. And that leads directly to step five, Pilot visibly.
Okay, we are going to put a pin in step five for just a moment because it is the engine of the entire framework and really deserves its own deep dive. But fundamentally, step five is taking that co-designed intervention and testing it in the real world. Let's move to step six. Measure what matters together.
Crucially, this is where you introduce the dashboard.
Mm-hmm.
But notice when it's introduced. Not at the beginning to force compliance, but at step six to measure a shared intervention.
Right.
And you use the dashboard not as an instrument of surveillance or punishment, but as an instrument of shared seeing. You measure the technical indicators, like water saved, but you also measure the lived experience. Does the community actually feel more secure?
Step seven, reflect without blame. I have to push back here. This sounds incredibly naive. Human beings love to assign blame. When a pilot program hits a snag, when money is wasted, the immediate political instinct is to point a finger and say, who messed this up? How do you possibly enforce a blame-free reflection in a high-stakes environment?
It is undeniably the most difficult step, but biologically, it is non-negotiable. Remember Maturana, when an organism feels threatened, its internal structure shifts into defense.
So if you bring blame into a reflection session, the stakeholders will immediately armor up.
Exactly. They will hide data, obfuscate timelines, point fingers. Learning completely shuts down.
So how do you reframe it then?
You change the question. Instead of asking who failed to execute the plan, the facilitator asks, what did the complexity of the real world just teach us about our initial assumptions? You treat the failure as vital new data about the system's structural constraints.
Ah, that's clever. And finally, step eight, adapt, scale, and institutionalize. You take the lessons from the reflection, you tweak the design, and you begin to encode it into the actual rules, budgets, and standard operating procedures of the organization or the city.
And then, importantly, the spiral continues. You go right back to step one and listen to how the newly scaled system is perturbing people. It becomes a permanent governance rhythm that builds deep institutional memory and structural trust over time.
Okay, let's pull that pin out of step five and zoom in on it, because the paper makes it abundantly clear that piloting visibly is the linchpin of everything. You can have the best theory, But people cannot just be told about a new world.
No, they have to experience it physically.
You can't just hand them a beautifully designed pamphlet about life coherence. Dr. Solly uses a fantastic term for these pilots. He calls them embodied perturbations.
Yes, embodied perturbations.
What makes a pilot program an embodied perturbation?
Well, when a community has heard 100 politicians give 100 eloquent speeches about impending change, words just lose their power to perturb. Cynicism acts as a structural shield, but a pilot program is a physical, living demonstration of a possible world.
So it breaks through the cynicism.
Right. It creates a temporary microclimate, a sandbox, if you will, where the rules of the old, misnested system are momentarily suspended.
I love that sandbox metaphor. Yeah. It's a contained space where the gravity works differently. I mean, if you just tell people they need to share resources, they will argue with you based on their fear of the current system. But if you put them in a sandbox where resource sharing is the rule and they see that they don't starve, the physical experience bypasses their cynicism entirely. It proves that a different pattern of relationship isn't just a utopian theory, but actually viable right now.
And the paper provides several highly specific, brilliant examples of these embodied perturbations. The first one is the concept of water-first communities.
Why start with water? Why not energy or housing?
Because water is the most immediate, visceral, life-ground condition. You can survive without electricity for a while. You cannot survive without water. When the tap runs dry, every other abstract economic concern instantly collapses.
Okay, so what does a water-first pilot look like? It's not just sending a plumber to fix a cracked pipe, right?
Well, fixing a pipe in isolation is just maintenance. A water-first pilot is a systemic intervention within that sandbox. It integrates leak detection technology, yes, but it also trains local citizens to monitor those systems.
Oh, getting the community involved.
Right. It mandates rainwater harvesting for the surrounding buildings. It implements community-led demand management during droughts. Suddenly, the community, the municipal engineers, and the finance officials are structurally coupling around the reality of water.
The paper has a great line about this. Water ceases to be just a utility fading into the background and becomes a national teacher. It teaches the community what it actually takes to be resilient.
Exactly. Another profound example in the paper is the healthy local school and hospital meals pilot.
I have to say, this one blew my mind a little bit because it takes something so incredibly mundane, a standard issue plastic tray of cafeteria food, and reveals it as a high-resolution dashboard of the entire life ground. Walk me through the mechanics of a school meal pilot.
It is the perfect illustration of renesting. In the misnested system, the school board buys the cheapest possible ultra-processed imported food to balance their departmental budget. But in this pilot, the school commits to sourcing meals from local farmers.
And the systemic impacts are massive.
Huge. You immediately create a reliable, guaranteed market for local agriculture, stabilizing rural livelihoods. You vastly improve the nutritional intake of the students, which over time lowers the hidden liability of childhood obesity and future health care costs.
And it connects to education because the students can actually visit the farms or grow some of the produce on school grounds.
All right. And it connects to waste management, because the organic waste from the cafeteria can be composted and returned to the local farms, completely closing the ecological loop.
A single plate of food in that sandbox proves to the entire community that you don't have to choose between economic viability and health. You can support local business, keep your kids healthy, and protect the soil all at the exact same time. The structural coupling happens right around the lunch table.
Precisely. Another pilot example is solarized clinics. This demonstrates renewable energy not merely as a carbon reduction goal, but as what the paper calls fiscal medicine.
Fiscal medicine. Yeah. Okay. How does putting solar panels on a rural health clinic act as medicine?
Think about the operating budget of a public clinic. A massive portion of it goes to paying the utility bill for electricity just to keep the lights on and the medicines refrigerated. If you install solar panels and battery storage, you dramatically lower that utility bill.
Which is great.
But here's the crucial governance trick. If that saved money just evaporates back into the general treasury, the local system learns absolutely nothing. The pilot requires that you ring-fence those savings.
You keep the money in the clinic.
Exactly. You mandate that the thousands of dollars saved on electricity must be reinvested directly into preventative care outreach, or better wages for the nurses, or facility maintenance. You make the invisible relationship intensely visible. The community literally sees that energy sovereignty pays for their health care.
That is brilliant. Then the paper introduces the Green Blue Youth Corps. This one requires a massive psychological shift in how governments usually view young people, doesn't it? Because normally, policy treats unemployed youth in two ways. Either they're risks that need to be policed to prevent crime, or they're passive beneficiaries who need welfare.
And both of those views completely strip the youth of agency. The pilot flips the paradigm entirely. It employs youth not as charity cases, but as paid, essential co-builders of the life ground.
The paper uses a biological metaphor here that I thought was striking. It says we should view youth as the immune cells of the society.
It's a really powerful image. What do immune cells do? They circulate throughout the body, they sense damage, they repair injured tissues, and they communicate across different systems.
Right.
A green-blue youth corps does exactly this. They are paid a dignified wage to map the underground water leaks, to restore the damaged coastal mangroves, to conduct energy audits on public buildings, to assist the elderly.
By giving them actual responsibility and a paycheck to repair the life ground, you completely change their structural orientation. They move from feeling alienated and resentful to feeling a deep sense of ownership and belonging. They are structurally coupled to the health of their own town.
The final pilot example is zero-waste tourism and farmer hotel agreements. This aims to transform tourism from an extractive industry, which typically drains local water, imports foreign food, and exports waste and profits, into an active steward of the destination.
Right, because if the reef dies and the water smells bad, the tourists stop coming anyway. The hotel's conserved concern, profit, relies entirely on the life ground.
Exactly. So the pilot creates a sandbox where the major hotel signs binding agreements to purchase a set percentage of local agricultural produce, mandates the elimination of single-use plastics across the resort, and implements advanced composting.
And it proves to the rest of the industry that a business can remain highly profitable while actively regenerating the place it depends on, rather than just consuming it to death.
Right. So we have the 8-step spiral, we have these incredible visible pilot programs in their sandboxes. But there is a massive caveat that Dr. Sully introduces next. We have to talk about the invisible atmosphere surrounding all of this.
Because you can have the most logically sound pilot, you can run the spiral perfectly, you can have flawless data, but if the emotional environment you introduce it into is toxic, it will absolutely fail.
This takes us right back to Majorana's biology of cognition. Majorana insists that every rational, logical domain of human action is fundamentally anchored in an emotional domain. We love to pretend that corporate strategy, public policy, and economics are purely objective and rational.
But human beings are biological, emotional creatures first.
Exactly. So the emotion determines the logic. Emotion defines the landscape of possible actions. If a group of stakeholders is gripped by fear, fear of losing revenue, fear of looking incompetent, and fear of being penalized, their internal structure restricts their available actions to defensiveness.
This is locked down.
Yes. They will delay, they will hide data, they will perform malicious compliance where they check the boxes, but actively subvert the spirit of the project.
But if the underlying emotion is trust or a sense of dignity,
then the structural landscape opens up completely. They become biologically available for learning. They're willing to take risks, admit gaps in their knowledge, and genuinely collaborate.
And the primary tool we use to set that emotional domain is language. The framework emphasizes languaging as an active process that can either open or close a stakeholder's world. Let's look at how language is normally used in, say, environmental campaigns. A regulator walks into a room full of tourism operators and says, "Your industry is inherently extractive, you are polluting the bay, and you are the problem we need to solve."
The moment those words are spoken, you have closed their world. Their biological response is immediate defense. They're no longer listening to your data. They're marshaling their lawyers and lobbyists to fight you.
But what happens if you change the languaging? What if you ask a different question?
If you walk into that same room and ask, "What is becoming harder for you to sustain in your business? We know you rely on a pristine bay to attract guests. How can we partner to protect the water quality that your entire industry's survival depends on?"
Oh, wow. That's a completely different approach.
You have completely altered the emotional domain. You have opened their world by validating their conserved concern. You invite them into a shared inquiry rather than an interrogation.
That shifts the entire dynamic from a paradigm of blame to a paradigm of responsibility. But I want to be really clear here. Does shifting away from blame mean we just ignore bad behavior? Do we stop holding polluters accountable just to protect their feelings?
No, absolutely not.
Yeah.
The framework demands rigorous honesty, extraction must be named. The hidden liabilities must be calculated and exposed. The harm being done to the life ground must be clearly articulated, but it distinguishes between blame and responsibility.
How so? What's the practical difference?
Blame is fundamentally backward-looking. Blame is about identifying a culprit, pinning the guilt on them, and shaming them. It is punitive, and it almost always triggers a defensive crouch.
Okay, and responsibility.
Responsibility, however, is forward-looking. Responsibility acknowledges the harm, but asks, what systemic conditions allowed this harm to occur? What actions are required to repair it? And what is your specific role in executing that repair? Blame seeks a villain. Responsibility seeks a builder.
And to get people to accept that heavy responsibility, to endure the inevitable loss, friction, and sacrifice that comes with tearing down a misnested system and building a new one, you need a very specific, powerful, emotional anchor. The paper identifies this ultimate emotion as love of place.
Yes. People will inevitably resist abstract bureaucratic mandates. They will find ways around a compliance checklist.
Mm-hmm.
But love. Love for their children's future. Love for their elders. Love for the coral reefs they grew up diving in. Love for the unique culture of their home.
That is an emotion potent enough to hold a community together through the pain of transition. It reframes what feels like a sacrifice into an act of profound stewardship. It gives the difficulty deep meaning.
Exactly. But even with all of this, love of place, perfect language, and great pilots, the paper warns that we need severe protection. We need guardrails.
Wow.
Because there are massive risks as a framework like this scales up from a local sandbox to a national or global level.
The risks of capture, dilution, and a slide back into technocracy are immense, right? I mean, the most immediate risk is that life coherence simply becomes the new flavor of corporate branding.
Greenwashing 2.0. A massive multinational corporation slaps a life coherent transition logo on their annual report, uses all the right Maturana jargon about structural coupling, but continues to dump toxic runoff into a river in the global south.
Exactly. Another distinct risk is that the Life Capital dashboard, which is supposed to be an instrument of shared seeing, just becomes another layer of dead bureaucratic red tape. Civil servants fill out the forms, hit submit, and it enters a database no one ever looks at. The participation becomes symbolic theater once again.
So to defend against that, the framework has actual guardrails to keep this honest. The primary guardrail is the rigorous, uncompromising application of the Life Capital test.
How does that test work?
It means that every single policy decision, every budget line item, every new pilot program must be forced to answer a fundamental empirical question. Does this action demonstrably increase the viability of the physical and social life ground for current and future generations?
So if a corporation uses the jargon but fails the physical test, if the river is still toxic, the framework identifies it as misnested. The physical reality must always verify the dashboard.
Yes. And the second guardrail the paper demands is absolute narrative honesty.
Meaning we have to cultivate a culture that is willing to publicly examine its own failures.
Right. If a government or an organization deploying this framework only ever issues press releases celebrating its uninterrupted successes, you can be certain it has devolved into branding. But complex systems fail. Pilots will fail. If the framework can publicly analyze those failures without blame and adapt, it remains a living, truthful process. If it hides the failures, it is dead.
Which brings us to the end of our journey today. Let's pull all of these threads together. What we have discovered through Dr. Solakdi's paper is that real, lasting transformation is never about perfectly transmitting data from the top of a hierarchy down to the bottom.
No, you cannot force buy-in onto a structurally determined human being.
True transformation is the grueling, beautiful work of designing recurrent, respectful interactions where stakeholders, with all their messy, legitimate concerns, can safely step into a sandbox and experience a new way of operating that actually protects the conditions of life.
It is the necessary evolution from merely achieving right distinction, having the perfect data and seeing the problem clearly, to achieving right relation, working with human beings as the biological, emotional entities they actually are.
I want you, the listener, to take a hard look at your own world right now. Think about a stalled project at your workplace, a bitter conflict in your local community group, or even a persistent argument within your own family. Are you currently trying to force buy-in by bludgeoning the other person with objective data and impeccable logic?
And is it working?
Right. Is it working? What would happen if tomorrow you stopped trying to persuade them and instead asked, what is it that you're trying to conserve right now? What would happen if you stopped arguing about the theory and instead try to co-design a tiny, visible pilot program, a little sandbox, to see if a new way could actually work.
And as you ponder that, I want to leave you with one final, deeply provocative thought drawn from a concept Maturana called objectivity in parentheses. We spend so much of our lives desperately trying to prove that we have the single objective truth. We wield our data, our dashboards, and our reports like weapons to defeat other people's perspectives.
But what if that absolute obsession with claiming objective truth is the very thing blinding us to reality?
If we can humble ourselves enough to acknowledge that every dashboard, every metric, and every worldview is just a chosen domain of distinction, that it only ever measures what someone decided was important to measure, we might realize something profound. We might realize that the only possible way to truly comprehend the whole picture is to stop trying to prove that we are objectively right and start genuinely co-participating with the subjective, messy, structurally determined realities of the people around us.
Because until you can do that, you are just standing in a control room staring at a perfectly formatted $50 million dashboard while the water pipe beneath your feet continues to burst.